Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, December 10, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandes. As the White House aggressively courts Turkey's leaders, Turks overwhelmingly oppose a US war on Iraq. Dick Cheney gets a judge's nod to keep energy secrets. And South Koreans travel to the US to demand US troop withdrawal from their country. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Commemorating International Human Rights Day, women in Afghanistan took the opportunity to point out that life for them now is not much better than it ever has been. Sonali Kolhatkar reports.
The Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, or RAWA, had their annual demonstration. Tehmina Faryal of RAWA describes how the march went.
This year's demonstration basically went very peaceful. We had a great number of participants. Of course, in the beginning, as always, we had problem with the police that did not want us to go ahead or did not want us to stay there for a long time, chanting our slogans or having our speeches. And we had to really argue with them to let us stand there or chant our slogans for a while.
According to RAWA, the United States is responsible for the return of the Northern Alliance, who RAWA says are terrorists. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sonali Kolhatkar.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway today and blasted President Bush's policies in his speech. But about 40 exiled Iranians demonstrated outside the proceedings shouting, "Shame on Carter." They blame Carter for the Iranian revolution that unseated the Shah and left the Ayatollah Khomeini in power. Others have criticized Carter for his part in the CIA organizing of death squads in Argentina, training Nicaraguan Contras in Honduras, and for sending Richard Holbrooke to South Korea, where he supported the military in crushing a worker and student-led pro-democracy movement. 3 days after the Iraqi declaration was delivered to the United Nations weapons inspectors, most members of the Security Council have said they doubt they will ever see the uncensored dossier, since U.S. officials took control of the document as soon as it came in the door. Heather Risby reports from the U.N.
While many non-permanent members of the Security Council have not issued any public statement, Syria, the only Arab nation on the Council, protested against the decision to give the document only to the U.S. first. Mikhail Wahbi, the Syrian ambassador, said the decision to allow the U.S. to see the document first was in contradiction to every kind of logic in the Security Council. Observers say the American diplomats pressed Colombian Ambassador Alfonso Valdivieso, who is also president of the Council this month, to allow the U.S. to be the first to take charge of the document. The U.S. recently announced major increase in military aid to Bogota. The U.S. and other four permanent members will now distribute the document among the non-permanent members of the Council only after censoring certain parts that deal with the technical aspects of the nuclear weapons production. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Supporters of the Venezuelan president spoke out en masse today, claiming the media is distorting the true nature of support for the maligned leader. Ginger Otis reports.
Supporters of President Hugo Chavez have taken to the streets. Yesterday, they surrounded several television and radio stations around the country to denounce what they call the media-backed ouster of their democratically elected leader. Another group of Chavistas reportedly ransacked the headquarters of television giant Globovisión. The demonstrators are showing their dislike of opposition party tactics, which of late consist of calling strike after strike in an effort to paralyze Venezuela's economy and remove Chavez from office. The latest strike is now entering its ninth day and has shut down much of the oil industry, a move which could precipitate U.S. involvement, since Venezuela is the nation's fifth largest oil supplier. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ginger Otis.
U.S. congressional black leaders say Senate leader Trent Lott's apology for racially offensive statements demand more than an apology. Jay Tamboli reports from D.C.
Lott said Friday that Mississippi had voted for Strom Thurmond as president in 1948.
And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
Thurmond ran on a segregationist ticket and based his campaign on keeping African Americans out of white schools. Senator Lott issued a statement Monday night calling his birthday speech, quote, a poor choice of words. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle said he accepted Lott's statement of regret, which explained that the Majority Leader didn't intend his words to be interpreted as supporting segregation. Leaders of the Congressional Black Caucus spoke out against Lott's statement and Daschle's immediate acceptance of the apology, including Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
It is not enough to simply defend or to explain these kind of statements and then at election time talk about why black Americans should turn out in large numbers.
Several members of Congress have called for Senate censure of Lott, and according to Diane Watson, the Progressive Caucus will be taking up a resolution asking for Lott to step down. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jay Tamboli.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As the Bush administration steps up its aggressive courting of Turkey's leaders, Turkish compliance being critical to a U.S. attack on Iraq, today the White House met with a key Turkish leader visiting Washington. Last week, Turkey agreed to let U.S. forces use Turkish bases in the event of a war with Iraq. Yet Washington knows well that Turkish support is not guaranteed. As Aaron Glantz reports from Istanbul, many Turks, as high as 80% of the population, do not want to follow their leader's alliance with the U.S. for a war on Iraq.
A gypsy band plays late into the night in a crowded cafe in the Beyazıt neighborhood of Istanbul. Almost all of the young people in this cafe are against the war, as are the vast majority of people who live in Turkey. A poll released this week by the Pew Research Center found more than 80% of Turks oppose the war. Mustafa Kemal is a manager at the Islamic TV station Channel 7. It's the most watched television station in Turkey with over 10 million viewers. Kemal says the Turkish people have already suffered enough from 10 years of economic sanctions against Iraq.
Güneydoğu'da ve Türkiye genelinde Irak'la ilgili ticaretten geçinen bir pek çok aile vardı.
There were more people who were earning from the trade with Iraq. Turkey was getting oil from Iraq. If we can't get oil from Iraq, we are paying more for the gas in our cars and heating in our homes has become more expensive for us. And so as we don't have any trade, the money is not coming from Iraq to us. We cannot be in relationship with a closer friend. It's 5 hours in a car and we cannot trade with them. And there are religious places in Iraq that are important to Turkey's Islamic people. So we can't go there and they can't come here. We have had many losses like this.
But despite popular opposition and the presence of an Islamic government in Turkey, the Turkish government seems ready to support the war in Iraq. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the leader of Turkey's ruling political party, flew to Washington today to meet with President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Last week, Turkey's ruling AKP party pledged to allow the U.S. to use its bases if President Bush gets the United Nations seal of approval for his war. At the same time, the United States government pledged $5 billion in new military aid. Turkey has the third largest army in the world, and 90% of its weapons come from the United States. Vakif Cemal Husak is a leader in Turkey's Sufi community. He supports the ruling AKP and opposes the war on Iraq.
But unfortunately, AKP, who control the power in Ankara, they will accept the U.S. policy against Iraq or a policy about oppression on Iraq, on any country. Iraq is just the beginning.
But Husak says he understands why the Turkish government is supporting the war against the will of the people. The United States, he says, holds sway over Turkish politics through the World Bank and the IMF. Turkey's debt to the international financial institutions stands at more than $100 billion. The payments are more than $7 billion a year.
If you are in debt of more than $100 million for IMF, you have to do something. You are imposed to do something. This is an unfortunate position. They have to accept.
And so Husek and nearly every other anti-war activist here says the only way to stop the United States is to get the American people to oppose the war. Anti-war activists here are watching the American street more than the Turkish one, hoping some sector of American society pulls Turkey out of a war no one here wants. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Aaron Glantz with Khaled Simohand in Istanbul.
And back in the U.S., a nationwide day of action took place today around the country calling for world peace and no war on Iraq. From a No Blood for Oil rally in Hadley, Massachusetts, to a Florence Peace Theatre Stop the War production in Florence, Oregon, people united to send a firm message to the White House. Ian Forrest attended the New York City rally and files this report.
Today, International Human Rights Day, saw more than 70 organizations around the United States mobilizing people of conscience to show their support for the anti-war movement. In a time when people have been deluged with opinions from the pro-war White House and less than equitable coverage the media has given in the build-up for war, these organizations came out with a message that another path is possible rather than beating the drums for war. One such group was the New York City Interfaith Gathering, who organized a rally to resist war and affirm human rights at the United Nations. Participants there were vocal in their opposition to the impending war.
No war! No war! No war! No war! No war! No war!
Brendan Fay of Dignity New York, a gay and lesbian Catholic group present at the rally, spoke of the commitment they had to seeing their efforts to derail the war succeed.
We will come out every day if we need to, and I hope that more religious leaders even come out, whether, for instance, Cardinal Egan, Bishop Daly. It would be wonderful to see more and more political, religious, community leaders, but moms and children and schools, all of us together, not just singing Christmas cards about peace, but literally taking our feet and taking our voices to the streets and to our politicians.
Bowie Snodgrass of Student Union Theological Seminary was very skeptical of America's march to war and believes the media has failed to represent the issues.
I think that the media and politics are swaying public opinion and are using fear and are using the economy to perpetuate the myth that we need this war. America right now is the richest country in the world. We have far more nuclear arms than everybody else. I think that what's happening in Iraq is an excuse. I think that the terrorism that has happened is a cry for America to think differently and not asking America to attack. I think America has worked really hard to keep the Middle East divided and out of power, and this is one more attempt at that.
With approval ratings for the current administration running high, John Long of the West New York Peace Center in Buffalo, which organized a rally at Lafayette Center earlier today, believes that movements all over the country experienced difficulties bringing people out.
I don't think it's easy organizing for peace anywhere, especially in this kind of odd time that we live in now, when the approval ratings for the president, who seems so intent on going to war, are so high. A lot of people who have misgivings about a war with Iraq, who are opposed to a war with Iraq, but who are reluctant to stand up and speak out and make their views known, because I think they feel alone. I think they feel that they're the only ones who think this way. And so part of the purpose of our rally is for some of us to stand up and hope that others will say, yes, this is what I think too, or I'm also opposed to this war. I don't want this. This is not what I wanted. Even people who voted for George Bush may be saying, you know, I really don't want a war. I just wanted to support the president after 9/11.
John Long of the West New York Peace Center in Buffalo. And as the day marked the 54th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights, the National Campaign of Civil Disobedience, organized in more than 40 cities around the U.S., expected around 5,000 people to participate today. A number of people at the UN rally in New York were arrested as they joined the National Campaign of Civil Disobedience and deliberately failed to comply with the police's instructions.
Back, please, folks. Back it up, please.
For more information, go to www.unitedforpeace.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ian Forrest at the United Nations.
Score one for Dick Cheney, Energy Task Force. Documents from the Vice President's secret meeting with energy industry leaders will remain secret, for now. A judge appointed by President Bush ruled late yesterday that Congress has no right to sue the White House to get meeting transcripts or even a list of the people Cheney met with in formulating the national energy policy. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
Some members of Congress suspect that the Vice President's Secret Energy Task Force, which helped write the energy policy, was dominated by polluting industry reps. The General Accounting Office, the investigative wing of Congress, was dispatched to get a list of the participants and transcripts of the meetings with Cheney. But the Vice President refused to cooperate, and the GAO took the White House to court for the first time in U.S. history. Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University, Susan Block, says the Bush White House is more secretive than any since Nixon.
In the past, they've usually worked it out amicably. This is the first time it's actually gone to court. And because the judicial branch has now said, GAO, if you don't come armed with a congressional subpoena, you lose. So it'll make it more difficult for the GAO on its own to do any negotiating in the future.
Congress could appeal the judge's decision not to let the GAO sue, but Professor Block says that probably won't happen with both houses now under Republican control. Sean Moulton with the government watchdog group OMB Watch calls the GAO case a big loss for the forces of government transparency.
Anytime we see inappropriate and improper restriction of information, then we take issue with that.
When the national energy policy was presented last May, environmentalists and consumer advocates were disappointed, to put it mildly. The White House called for more oil and gas drilling on public lands and more nuclear power plants. In a separate lawsuit, the Sierra Club and the conservative think tank Judicial Watch are also suing for the Energy Task Force documents. David Bookbinder is senior counsel for the Sierra Club.
It became clear early on in the process that the oil industry and the gas industry and the nuclear industry were invited into the White House, given the red carpet treatment, allowed to present their wish list for what the administration's energy policy would contain, but that the consumers and the environmental groups were given no role whatsoever in developing this plan. And the law says you can't do that. You can't come up with these sorts of national plans in secret if you only listen to half the available information out there.
While the Sierra Club's case continues, Bookbinder says he wasn't surprised the GAO case was shot down. U.S. District Judge John Bates said in dismissing the case that letting Congress sue the White House would, quote, fly in the face of the restricted role of the federal courts, unquote. Sean Moulton at OMB Watch points out Judge Bates is a recent Bush appointee.
Is there some kind of dark conspiracy here?
I don't know, but it certainly seems that the court system is unwilling to step in and act, as I think it should, as a check. The fact that these Energy Task Force records are taking such effort to pry loose, gives me the indication that they must be pretty damning.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, oil and gas mining interests gave $35 million in campaign contributions in the 2000 federal election cycle, four-fifths of that money to Republicans. The Department of Energy reported this month that consumption of energy from less polluting renewable resources like solar, wind, and biomass fell sharply in 2001. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
The American Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage arrived in South Korea to be greeted by the biggest anti-American protests the country has seen in recent years. The acquittal last month of two U.S. soldiers who killed two South Korean schoolgirls has fueled resentment against the 37,000 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. Meanwhile, Korean Americans in Los Angeles gathered in a candlelight vigil last night to condemn the acquittal of the U.S. servicemen. They say the servicemen's trial was a sham, and they're demanding that President Bush remove U.S. troops from South Korea. Justin Stinchcomb reports from Los Angeles.
Some 200 gathered at last night's vigil, then marched through Los Angeles' Koreatown to hear speeches by delegates from Korea to the U.S. The deaths of teenagers Shin Hyo-shan and Shim Mi-sun have catalyzed public hostility to the presence of more than 37,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. A delegation, determined to deliver a petition with more than a million signatures, demanding real justice for the teenagers and jurisdiction over U.S. troops for Korean authorities, arrived in Los Angeles yesterday. They've just returned from a week of picketing outside the White House, where they wrote on the sidewalk in blood and staged a hunger strike, but got no response from the Bush administration. Delegate Sang-ryul Han is a pastor at Kobek Church in Chunju, South Korea. He says the death of the teenagers isn't an isolated incident. Han says U.S. troops and their families have committed more than 100,000 crimes since the end of the Korean War.
There are more than 100,000 incidents that U.S. military have been involved in the incidents last 45 years.
Public hostility has culminated in violent demonstrations at U.S. military bases and a boycott of U.S. goods, including food from McDonald's and the new James Bond movie. Korean-American Grace Lee teaches at a Los Angeles Technical College. She says she came to last night's vigil to ask for real justice.
The military tried the accused and essentially let them go. It feels like the judge and the jury and the prosecutor are all wrapped in one. Korea is the most heavily U.S. militarized zone in the world, and I think that's shocking. And I think if they're there to protect and serve the Korean people, they should listen to the Korean people who want the military to leave.
Others at the vigil were concerned by the Bush administration's escalating rhetoric against North Korea and the possibility of renewed war. Pasadena Minister Hee Yong-sung says the Bush administration came into office determined to reverse recent advances toward reunification between North and South.
After Bush became president, Bush just attacked, this kind of sunshine policy and tried to isolate North Korea again. So Korean people really worried about this kind of policy. We don't want a war. The U.S. policy and the presence of U.S. Army really against our peaceful relationship with North and South, and also peaceful prospect of reunification of Korea.
The U.S. State Department issued an apology Monday for the teenagers' deaths, but many at last night's vigil say that's inadequate. They want a full apology from President Bush himself and a permanent change in relations between the U.S. and Korea. Anti-U.S. sentiment is playing into Korea's December 19th elections. The two leading candidates are distancing themselves from the U.S. amid rising sentiment against Korea's most prominent ally. For Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles, I'm Justin Stinchcomb.
Within weeks of the arrest of some 94 people at this year's School of the Americas protest, the federal government, Friday, released 11 of the 36 prisoners of conscience from last year's protest. Jack Hickey reports.
Rich Ring just got out of jail, 30 pounds lighter and lots hairier. His commitment to direct action remains. He quips about what he learned behind bars that will serve him next time. He's booked a flight to Guatemala for later this month so that he can do accompaniment work, serving as a human shield to witnesses there who are under death threat. He speaks about his experience and what it means.
And I didn't sort of sit down one day and think, what's the most important? I just took what was there. The School of the Americas, because I went and lived in Guatemala and saw the effects of the School of the Americas. My mother came and hit it right on the head when she visited. She said, this place is such a failure of the imagination. It's a giant waste of money and of lives. I mean, if you're talking about changing prisons, I can't really envision the right prison. You're really talking about alternatives to prison. Politically right now, prison is a profit industry, which gets you right back to the School of the Americas, which is sort of the goon wing of U.S. foreign policy, which is an economic policy at bottom.
When Dorothy Day recognized the American way as this stinking corrupt system and formed the Catholic Workers in the 1930s, she planted some of the seeds for this movement. The Jonas House in Baltimore, founded by Philip Berrigan, is one such Catholic worker community. Half the just-released SOA prisoners of conscience attended Philip Berrigan's funeral yesterday, along with the national staff of SOA Watch. They all sang with spirit. Berrigan's daughters delivered a joint eulogy. They did not say their father lived on in heaven, but that he is present in each of us when we do his work of protest and activism and suffer prison as a result. A friend of his for 35 years, Brendan Walsh, also spoke.
Philip Berrigan is a friend to all those who are bombed and scattered, imprisoned, tortured, who are robbed and beaten and left for dead in ditches all over this planet. Stokely Carmichael observed that Philip Berrigan was one of the few white people in this country who actually knew what was really going on. All of us are sisters and brothers to one another. And when one of us suffers an injury, all of us suffer the injury. As we Irish people say, he fought the famine and he fought the crown. And as soon as he completed one stint in jail, he was organizing yet another plowshare action. Phil Berrigan would repeat for us today the last words of Joe Hill. Don't mourn for me, organize.
Eric LeCompte is a national organizer for the School of the Americas Watch. He summarizes this thinking about oppression and resistance, imprisonment and hope.
So I think what we are seeing, you know, nationwide is the criminalization of dissent. Now happening with people who are just getting involved. What it says to us is that it's more important than ever to be closing the SOA. So now we're seeing our government here in the United States increase the pressure. What we're finding is that people aren't being intimidated by this. It's just the opposite. People are surging up. In light of this, more and more people are rising up and raising their voices for peace and justice here in the United States and in our world.
At last month's SOA vigil in Georgia, music and artistic expression were everywhere. Sometimes this cultural outpouring is as powerful as the deadliest ordinance.
We'll teach one by one, children peace one by one, till all war one by one, hunger cease one by one.
From Baltimore, Maryland, this is Jack Hickey for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at WBAI by Kata Mesta. Headlines editor at WMNF in Tampa, Florida is Randy Zimmerman. Technical producers at KPFA in Berkeley are Jade Paget-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone. Our DC editor is Josh Chaffin at WPFW. We have production assistance from Carlos Fawada and Rosalind Fay. We have web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. You can go to our website at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.